Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Longtime area residents have fond memories of Ozark Airlines, their longtime local airline, a trip down memory lane in a couple of moments. But first, the reality of big city life. St. Louis is undergoing an increase in crime, especially violent crime. The law enforcement community is scrambling, looking for ways to curb it. Joining me in studio to talk about the problem and potential solutions are Sam Dotson, the chief of the St. Louis Police Metropolitan Department, St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department, that is. And also with us is Rick Rosenfeld, criminologist at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, who also advises the St. Louis PD as an analyst and consultant. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us. Chief, good to see you again. And good to hear that you have some good news for us on the ambush shooting of earlier this week.
It is. We actually have the individual that was responsible for shooting our officer in custody. We got him in custody about an hour and a half ago after about 48 hours of officers really doing what they do best, detective work, chasing down leads. Shortly after the shooting on Tuesday, we located the vehicle that was used. It provided us some more information. We got the driver of that car into custody. He provided us some more. And this morning early, we sent quite a few detectives out to knock on doors, and we have that subject in custody right now.
Where did you find him, and did he resist arrest?
We found him in an apartment in Maplewood, just outside of the city limits, and he did resist arrest. A taser was used, and there was a physical struggle, but he was brought into custody, and he's in our interrogation room right now, trying to really understand what he was thinking, what that group was thinking that night, what their purposes were.
And you have one more to go?
There were four people in that car. We have three of the four right now, and we're looking for the fourth, and we know who that is by name.
I understand that one of these individuals claims that the officer got out of his car and started this whole thing.
Well, and I have said from the beginning that that area is heavily camered, and I've seen the video of that shooting, and I've watched it multiple times. The car that the suspects were in pulled up and parked directly in front of the police officer. The passenger got out of the car, and immediately shots were fired. The officer never got out of his patrol, the car that he was in, never got out of the car. The officer did return fire, but from a seated position in the car. So what was reported by an attorney, I've seen the video, that did not happen.
It has been suggested that this ambush, as you've categorized it, may have actually been in retaliation for the shooting of a young man by a police officer earlier in the week in which the young man was paralyzed.
And I've heard that, but I have seen nothing in our investigation that leads me to believe that this was a retaliatory action for the police officer-involved shooting that happened over the weekend. Right now, if you're asking me, I think they're completely separate incidents.
All right. Well, anything else we should know about the case at this point?
Well, I think, and I said it earlier in the week, the officer was extremely fortunate that his ballistic vest did exactly what the ballistic vest was supposed to do. It stopped a bullet that would have certainly done serious harm to him if not killed him. And that's probably the thing I worry most about as being police chief, the safety of our officers. To see him reunited with his wife and his young child in the emergency room at the hospital, I get goosebumps now even thinking about it, because he got to go home with his family that morning and back to his life.
And all too often that is not the case. Well, Rick Rosenfeld, more statistics for you to work with. I'll just refresh everyone's mind. The most recent numbers I have, an increase in crime in St. Louis of 14% so far this year, 60% increase in homicides. What are these numbers telling you?
They're telling me that we have a serious problem in the city. These increases come on the heels of a long-term crime decline. When I've been on this program in the past, we've often talked about that long-term decline. Certainly in the city of St. Louis in 2014 and now the first half of the current year, that decline has, at least for now, ended. The other thing I'd like to say, though, is that although we don't know how widespread crime increases are across the country, we should know, but we don't. What little information we have suggests that crime is going up in a number of other cities, not just St. Louis. So St. Louis is not alone.
Do we have any indication as to why this is happening?
Well, in order to get that kind of research done, one would have to know, first of all, how many of our large cities really are experiencing crime increases and in what crime categories. We don't have that information. We should have it. The FBI should be making monthly crime data available. State of Missouri, any of your listeners can go up on the Highway Patrol's website and get last crime statistics for any locality in the state of Missouri as of the end of last month, as of the end of June. The FBI uses that information and yet sits on it for months and months. So that's another story. I'll end that sermon. But we should be able to have a comprehensive picture of crime increases across the country. So then we could really be systematic about delving into causes. Right now, I would look at local factors because it's a handful of cities that have been reported with increases. In the city of St. Louis, it's not entirely clear to me. I think a lot of this increase is related to violence associated with drug markets, but some of the increase is not.
Chief, the information that I have indicates that the largest number of homicides have been taking place in some of the hotspot policing areas. Let's see, we've got Jeff Vanderloo, I guess it is, and the Ville and the Wells Goodfellow neighborhoods.
Right.
I think people will look at that and say, well, this hotspot policing isn't working.
Well, I think what you have to look at is in the context. While we don't know the reasons why violence is rising, what we do know is over the last 10 years, crime has down 50%, including those neighborhoods. The last 5 years, crime is down 25%, including those neighborhoods. So while law enforcement, it's my job, it's our job to go out and address those issues, there are lots of systemic factors that live in the background. Education, jobs, substance abuse, the availability of guns, availability of drugs. So we continue to do our strategies, focus resources into hotspots, and with the help of Dr. Rosenfeld, added a layer focusing on the individuals that we know are responsible for the crimes. We've also looked for assistance from our prosecutors. You just saw recently an article in the Post-Dispatch that talked about taking cases to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Just yesterday, we got murder charges issued at a federal level, which is something that we haven't been doing before. So we have to really look at those neighborhoods and find the best sources, the best way to prosecute those cases when we do make arrests. Because I'll say, and then I'll move on, we don't always see the outcomes in the circuit court, the state court, in the city of St. Louis that I believe keep us safe.
Is it risky at all for you to be critical as you have been, of the courts and of judges in particular that don't handle gun crimes to your liking?
Well, if it's risky or not, it doesn't matter. It's my job to address crime, and I would think that the courts would be interested in the feedback and not want to live in anonymity behind the bench. So if there's a piece of the criminal justice system, and the research that's been done by Dr. Rosenfeld and by the Circuit Attorney's Office shows that in cases like UUW, unlawful use of a weapon, that in 61% of the time over a time period, 61% of the time, those individuals were given probation and sent right back out onto the streets. Recidivism, the rate at which those people reoffend, is as high as 70%. So 7 out of those 10 people that are out on the street are reoffending. So it creates a revolving door for law enforcement. So if we want to talk about a strategy to keep people safe, when we arrest somebody, let's hold them accountable.
Rick, your thoughts on that?
Yeah. There's no risk for me in criticizing the courts. So here's my critical comment. I think it's essential for the courts. I used to say important. Now I think essential under current conditions to establish the so-called armed offender docket or gun docket. The reason is not necessarily to reduce the rate at which people are put on probation, though that may happen. The reason one sets up a specialized court is because that, which is run by one or two judges, that develops in those individuals expertise about those cases. These are the most serious cases that come through the state courts. We want expertise developed so that judges have a sense, they have good data in front of them, they've seen time and time again the same folks doing the same kinds of things. They have a much better sense of, well, what will happen if I put this individual on probation, or if I gave this individual a year shock time and then put him or her on probation. That kind of expertise is really lacking when any of the a couple of dozen judges can get one of these cases. So that's my pitch for the courts to develop a specialized docket.
What about Amendment 5, as we're looking for reasons for this spike, the gun rights amendment passed by voters? Do you think that has any bearing at all on what's going on?
Well, the honest answer is I don't know. I'm not at all certain how many, for example, would-be firearm offenders in the city of St. Louis or elsewhere are aware of this rather permissive amendment. And when I say permissive, I mean that in Amendment 5, our old felon in possession prohibition of legally possessing a firearm has been undermined. Right now, Amendment 5, in its plain language, says in order to be prohibited from carrying a firearm, the felon must have been, quote, a violent felon. And as has been reported in the news, the Circuit Attorney's Office has appealed the case, and the city has filed an amicus brief. I was assisting in that brief. I think Amendment 5 in that interpretation is absolutely wrongheaded. And I would not be surprised if that contributed somewhat to the uptick in firearm violence in the city.
I think the Archdiocese has also went on this challenge.
Exactly right.
Chief, your thoughts about that?
Yeah. Anything that makes it more easier for criminals to have guns and more difficult to prosecute them are risk factors for us. One thing, and it's in the gun arena, I've seen an almost 70% increase in stolen guns this year, most of them out of vehicles. So people will go to a baseball game or a concert downtown. They can't take their weapon in with them, but they think it's a good idea to bring it and leave it locked in their cars. Criminals know that, and they will break into 5, 6, 7 cars in a row looking for that firearm. They find one. It's a win for them. That gun immediately goes into the underground, into the hands of criminals. So there's no mandatory reporting for stolen guns. I think that's something that we have to address. I think the city of St. Louis needs to look at specific gun laws for our area, like Chicago has done, to add a layer that the state hasn't done to hold criminals accountable when they use guns in the city.
You know, I would think that in some degree, though, the toothpaste is out of the tube on this. The guns are out there, you know, and they're not going to go away.
And so let's have the conversation about that. 95% of the homicides that we have in the city of St. Louis involve a firearm. So we can't talk about violence that's happening in the city unless we talk about the availability of guns and the prosecution of criminals that are caught with guns. So while, yeah, I agree with you, there are over 300 million guns in the United States, the fact that they're out there should not be a detriment. We should be able to have a civilization, a community that is not plagued by gun violence. What we have now is a community where individuals who are used to go behind the school and let's settle a dispute that we have with a fist fight over the honor of a young lady in some cases, they now go to their cars, pull out their guns, and start shooting. And then the collateral damage is the heartbreaking for me. When a grandma is gunned down because individuals are shooting each other, when a young child is struck by gunfire, those are the tragedies. At some point, as a community, we have to stand up and say guns have to be controlled in a different way. And I understand the Second Amendment. I'm not doing that. But when guns are used to kill almost 100 people in the city of St. Louis, and we're in July, we have to do something about it.
That is Sam Dotson. He's the chief of the St. Louis Police Department. He's with me in studio, as is Rick Rosenfeld, criminologist at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and a consultant also with the St. Louis Police Department. We're talking about violence in the city, gun violence and otherwise, and the increase in crime that has been noted earlier in this program. We'll come back, continue the conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to have you join us. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. We'll take an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or a tweet at STL on air. Back in a moment, this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back as we continue our conversation with Sam Dotson, the chief of the St. Louis Police Department, and Rick Rosenfeld of the University of Missouri, St. Louis. We talked about the proliferation of guns. And it has to be pointed out that guns aren't the only problem. They certainly are a big problem. But there are other factors that that cause people to be violent, and among them is poverty, lack of education, many things that we could point to. Rick, wouldn't you agree with that?
Oh, there's no question. And if we're trying to understand why a city like St. Louis may have crime rates that are considerably higher than Beverly Hills, California, over time, there's no question the degree of economic disadvantage in this city is an important culprit. But if we're trying to understand why crime has gone up, you know, why homicides have increased over 50% over the last year and a third the year before, poverty didn't all of a sudden increase by that much. There are other factors at work. And once we begin looking at those factors a little bit closer to the ground, if you will, firearms play an enormous role. The chief has pointed out one good indicator of being awash in firearms is the degree to which firearm thefts have increased in the city. Thefts of firearms put more firearms into circulation among high-risk people, people who would not otherwise be eligible to carry a firearm. And to make matters worse, this is my personal view, it makes utterly no sense for the courts to permit convicted felons to carry, legally carry and possess a firearm in St. Louis. So yes, there are a lot of guns, and we're not going to get rid of them overnight, nor perhaps should we, but we can better regulate the use of those guns.
Chief, you said something off the air that I found quite startling, and that being that 88 people out of every 100 in this country have guns.
Well, the 300 million number for guns says that for every 100 people in the United States, there are 88 guns. And so we talk about the proliferation, and so many of those guns are stolen. There are still loopholes in the gun laws. We saw how even the bureaucracy can affect, and 9 people were murdered in the church. So we still have lots of issues around gun control. Gun shows happen almost monthly around the region. Guns are bought, traded, exchanged with no records at all. It's a problem.
Getting back to the area of prevention, you've established a new task force or are in the process of doing it. Tell us about that and how that's structured.
We're actually going to make the announcement on Monday. The task force.
Make it here.
The task force is already in place and already working. And it's something that I haven't seen. And it's really a focus of the FBI, a refocus of the FBI into local issues, local problems. So there's a task force that's made up of St. Louis City, FBI, St. Louis County, and then DEA, ATF. But the key is the prosecutors are also sitting with us at the table. Jennifer Joyce is sitting with us, Bob McCullough, and the U.S. attorney. So right now we develop cases, and at the very onset of the case, we're deciding what's the best venue for prosecution, what evidence do we need. And we're targeting individuals. It's working very well so far. You just heard recently a raid that was done in Dogtown in St. Louis City. 45 guns were seized, over 45 guns. 15 assault rifles were among those guns. Pounds of marijuana, pounds of heroin. That task force is working. So two focuses, interdiction of drugs, rapid response to violence on the street.
Rick, you analyze such things. Is this a good plan? Do you see it as a workable plan?
Oh, absolutely. Especially if it's coupled with the kind of proactive enforcement activity that this department has been engaged in for some time. By that, I mean, in addition to task forces that respond to crime as effectively as the chief just described, the department also engages in, and I would say should engage in, even more systematically, the so-called hotspot strategy, targeting those places where crime is most heavily concentrated, and these days that should be firearm violence, and then identifying in those places the individuals who are most likely to be arrested in those places are still on the streets, visiting them, having police officers visit them, social service providers being made available to them. This kind of carrot and stick principle can work. And that's our best, most effective strategy, it seems to me, for stemming the tide of the increase in firearm violence we've seen in the city.
We have a caller here that I think would weigh in on this particular part of our discussion. Sam in St. Louis, welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks very much. I appreciate everything that the panelists have been saying. I understand that this is an extremely complex issue, but I would like to throw out there this observation. A number of cities around the country that have decided to abandon what is called the broken window policy, the zero tolerance policy on crime, are seeing increases in crime. And I realize that you're talking about violent crime, but other crimes lead to other crimes. And I just wonder if it's a bit premature, that the panelists would comment on whether it's a bit premature to be abandoning a zero tolerance policy, since it may be responsible for the low crime rates we've seen for the last two decades.
Well, the broken windows situation is that you crack down on the small crimes in order to prevent larger ones later.
I'm a huge believer, a huge proponent of the broken windows theory. I think if a community allows those smaller infractions in some cases to go unaddressed, that the criminal element sees that as, well, nobody cares in our community, nobody cares in our neighborhood, and take advantage of that. That's why I have officers in each neighborhood, in each district, that focus on those quality of life issues, problem properties, those neighbors you don't want living in your neighborhood. So we do that. It's some days it's an uphill battle because everybody has due process. But no, I do believe in the broken windows theory, and we do practice it here.
Rick?
Yeah, I think it's also important. I wouldn't exaggerate, however, its importance. There's something of a stretch between fixing up broken windows, removing trash from vacant lots, cutting the grass, and the kind of firearm violence that we've been discussing. So I wouldn't assume that keeping up the neighborhood, if you will, as important as that is over the long run, is going to be a short-term fix for our firearm violence problem.
All righty, let's bring in another caller. Ron will join us from Ferguson. Ron, go ahead. You're on the air.
I would just like to reemphasize, I'm a believer in the broken windows, and I'm not necessarily talking about trash and talking about people driving through the city playing loud music, throwing trash out the windows, some of the more petty crimes. I just think that if you crack down on those more, that would help. I think we should publish the statistics of judges that do these sentences and look at the recidivism rate based upon the ones that get out with light sentences and come back and commit crimes. And those judges should be held accountable, at least in the public eye. And these kids under 18, the parents aren't held responsible. So I've been on jury duty before, and you have a 15-year-old that's out at 3 o'clock in the morning with an AK-47 and in a stolen car, and the parent is at home watching TV. Why aren't they required to come to court every time this individual and all of them be held responsible? Because as an adult, they are responsible for the actions of their kids, and maybe they have to do community service, counseling, and all of that. But you have to hold these parents accountable. A lot of these parents just don't give a damn.
Ron, thank you for the call. I think he's touching some of your buttons, Chief.
He is. And one of the things that I've challenged my command staff to do is when we do arrest a juvenile in a stolen car or out past curfew, that we go to the house and we write the parent a summons and require them to show in front of a city court judge and explain why their child was out after curfew in a stolen car. So that is a strategy that we are implementing. I think it's going to pay results, but like everything else, it's slow because it's really one family at a time. For the judges, I absolutely agree. I've talked about creating a tracking system for the judges. As soon as I say that, and my phone will probably start ringing now from the judges going, hey, wait a minute. But I think they work for you. They work for us. They work for the community. And they have to be as accountable as the police department, as the mayor, as every elected official in the city.
Judges, my observation is, often don't like to be told what to do.
Well, and this isn't when we talk about an armed offender docket, it's not about guilt or innocence. What it is about is having those outcomes. And I was the PIO, the public information officer for the courts, when I wrote a blog just a week ago about a judge that put a young man on probation for UUW who we arrested for a murder and was charged with a murder, said that gun courts were unconstitutional. I could not disagree with that more. We can do it for drug courts. We can do it for juvenile courts. We can do it for veterans courts. We can do a variety of courts. There just has to be the will on the court's part.
Rick Rosenfeld, is there any kind of a breakdown with the number of violent gun crimes that are committed with legal firearms as opposed to illegal ones?
That's difficult information to come by. The persons who commit those crimes typically are not legally able to possess a firearm. Now, if you're asking about the firearm itself, when it's in the possession of someone who's in unlawful use, no, that's an illegal firearm. So the vast majority of cases, these are persons who are not legally entitled to own or possess a firearm. But note, that's been weakened somewhat by Amendment 5, because now a felon, given the plain language of the amendment, a felon does not have to be simply convicted of past felonies, no matter how many. They have to be so-called, quote, violent felonies. Mm-hmm. And the deal there is, what does that language mean, violent felon? Does it mean a felon who was convicted of any sort of felony, who's exhibited violent behavior? Or does it mean somebody who's been convicted of the relatively small number of felonies that are so-called violent felonies? The research suggests, by the way, that being convicted of a prior felony predicts future violent felony, whether the prior conviction was for violent or nonviolent felony.
Chief, coming back to the court situation, the President of the United States, as you're probably aware, today is visiting a prison, I think in Ohio, I'm not sure, maybe Indiana. But basically, one of the things he's lobbying for is doing away with mandatory minimum sentences. We have a lot of people incarcerated who maybe shouldn't be there or shouldn't be there for as long as they're. Your thoughts on that?
Well, as a police chief, I see repeatedly people coming through the criminal justice system. And we talked about probation on top of probation on top of probation. So while I think everybody deserves to have their case looked at independently and individually, we have to have some consistency through sentencing. And so mandatory minimums do provide some of that. Are they the answer? They're an answer. Are they the right answer? I don't know. What I'm talking about, though, are outcomes that keep our community safe. If mandatory minimums keep our community safe, then that's the right answer.
Rick?
Yeah, I'm not in principle opposed to mandatory minimums. The problem is the length of the sentence that has been embedded in those minimums. It seems to my own personal view is that somebody who with prior felonies on their record, who is convicted of unlawful possession or use of a firearm in the city of St. Louis, should get a minimum of 1 year in prison, followed by carefully monitored supervision in the community. Now, that's a mandatory minimum that I can live with. I'm not sure about the chief. It's getting somebody off the street. Who's posing an imminent danger to others, that's key here.
Chief, did you?
And what I'm looking for are the outcomes. So if we give that person, while they're incarcerated, new education skills, new job skills, deal with substance abuse issues, even in something as simple as conflict resolution, and they come out of that mandatory minimum a little better than when they went in with new skill sets, hey, I could support that. That's what we need. When probations are used, the individual doesn't get those new skill sets, and they go right back into the environment, and they're left with, in many cases, no option to accept to commit crimes again and again and again.
One other area that I want to touch on before we have to say goodbye, and that is your effort to add 160 officers to the police department. That seems to be stalled at the present time. Where does it stand, and where is it going to go?
Well, and you're absolutely right. It does appear to be stalled right now. Last October, Mayor Slay and I started to talk about the need to add police officers. I could see the trends were moving up. For the last 20 years, as a nation, crime has been going down. Crime has been going down in St. Louis. We started to see this uptick. When I came on in 1993, about 20 years ago, a little more, there were 1,600 police officers in the Metropolitan Police Department. There are less than 1,300 now. And if crime is going to go up, we need to add more police officers. So the Board of Aldermen need to act and to put some measures in front of the voters in the city of St. Louis for some modest fee increases, graduated business license, some licensing fees. Those need to be increased, and that could pay for the new officers. Key here, though, startup time for me, spin-up time, 18 to 24 months. So if we acted right now, today, which they're not, It would take me 18 to 24 months to get those officers in a productive spot.
It was hoped it would be on the ballot in November, and that's not going to happen.
It appears not, yes.
A funding proposition. Rick, 160 officers make a difference?
Yes. That's not just my personal view. Yeah, the research is pretty clear. You add police officers, especially if they're put in the kind of proactive enforcement position that this department puts many officers in, yes, you do reduce crime.
Right. Okay, one final question, and that is the role of the media in all of this. We've talked about this before. Chief, I'll put this to you first, and we'll need a relatively quick response. How much impact does media coverage of these crimes have on crime itself, do you think?
I think it has a tremendous amount. I think it portrays a vision of lawlessness. I think it portrays a negative image. And we kind of talked about, I think the doctor said, economics are the key. When people Google St. Louis and the media says, bad place, crime is up. They don't bring conventions. They don't bring business. They don't come on tourists for vacations. We need the tax base. We need the revenue if we're going to grow the city to fix roads, streets, schools, poverty, all of those things.
Rick, quick thought.
Yeah, I tend to agree. St. Louis has not had good press in recent years, especially with the crime rankings that the media has been interested in, though that's subsided somewhat. And I want to say the media has been performing a public service recently by digging into city-level crime statistics to determine which cities are up and perhaps which are not. They're doing due diligence in the absence of the Uniform Crime Reports program from the FBI, our nation's official crime reporting program, providing monthly crime statistics the way they should.
Right. We've talked about this before, too, but I'm just reminded that the Ferguson situation of last summer, you do not believe that the Ferguson fallout has any impact on this, or do you?
I didn't find much evidence that the homicide increase in St. Louis through the end of 2014 could be attributed to Ferguson, because that increase began prior to Ferguson. Other violent crime, perhaps, and property crime, at least the timing was right there. Now, we've seen continuing increases through 2015, not only in St. Louis. I'm a little hard-pressed to argue that all of that or most of that is due simply to Ferguson, New York City, Cleveland, those instances. In the city of St. Louis, arrest rates did come down as officers were redeployed to address protest activity. Arrest rates are back up. The Ferguson effect argument suggests that officers are unwilling to get out of their patrol cars, unwilling to fully engage in their jobs because of legal liability, community tension, so forth. If there's evidence for that, I'd like to see somebody produce it. I've heard anecdotes, but I haven't seen any systematic evidence.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Time is up. Sam Dotson, Chief of the St. Louis Police Department, thanks so much for being with us, and congratulations to you and yours for bringing in this suspect and the shooting of the police officer the other day. Rick Rosenfeld, great to see you again,
too. Good to see you, Dan.
Coming up, we remember Ozark Airlines. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.